It's the Popmatic Podcast for September 28th, 2016.
Take my word for it. It's not unreasonable to ask you to take out just this one book.
I mean, I couldn't remove a book because it has ideas we don't like. Isn't this one book? We have an entire stack of books on political theory of all shades. What will happen if you start getting letters about them?
Coming to you from the Ministry of Truth, it's the Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I'm Jeremy, and joining me today are...
Bill.
Napoleon the Pig.
Sarah.
Amanda.
So, you can get a copy, let me tell you some information. You can get a copy of the Bible, the Quran, or Fight Club at your public library.
You can't talk about Fight Club.
That's true. Mm. That is true. Maybe I should have used it. You can get Junie B. Jones, The Hunger Games, and Mein Kampf at the library. We've got it all because we believe in intellectual freedom. And Banned Books Week, which runs September 25th through October 1st, sort of sounds like it's a week where we're going to ban books, but in fact, it's the opposite. It celebrates the freedom to choose to read whatever you want. Amanda?
Yes, Jeremy.
Do you have any bad puns about the word banned?
I don't. I saved those for you guys because you're so good at it.
That's great. That's very generous of you.
You're welcome. I'm a giver.
I'll put that in your file.
Okay, so today I'm going to start by explaining why my family does not have an official crest, like in old England where everybody had a banner and a flag, and we don't have one of those. But if we did, underneath a purple glittery fleur-de-lis on a field of neon orange checkerboard, ours would say, Gluteus uber maximus in familium, which loosely translates to butts are big in our family. Which, if you know me, you know we say it all the time. That's just a family joke.
Does that mean butts are popular in your family, or butts tend to be larger?
Size-wise. Oh,
size-wise. I heard that the crest was founded by Sir Mix-a-Lot.
It was, because, you know, baby got back. So
he was a knight. You know.
That's right. He was knighted.
He is Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Yes,
that's
pretty awesome.
So when I saw the title for the book, The Earth, My Butt, and Other Big Round Things, I knew I had to read it. And author Carolyn Mackler wrote this young adult novel in 2003, and it follows the life of Virginia Shreves. Now, the Shreve family lives in New York City, and Virginia is the youngest of three siblings. Her oldest, rowdy, you know, but mostly perfect sister, Anais, has gone to Africa in the Peace Corps. Her perfect movie star, handsome older brother is attending Columbia University. Her mother is a skinny, world-renowned child psychologist, and her father works in big business and is always talking about how he likes his women skinny. Now, Virginia, unfortunately, is not skinny. And Mackler's book deals with this fact, as well as the fact that Virginia feels very isolated. This is partially because she feels like she was switched at birth because she's not perfect like her brother and sister, and partially because her best friend has moved to Walla Walla, Washington for the year with her author parents, who were writing about onions, which is kind of random, but I've enjoyed.
I've heard there are a lot of layers to onions.
There are a lot of depth to be.
Mike, you have me in tears.
So now Virginia has no one to hang out with. She's kind of seeing this guy whose name is really Froggy. That's his given name. But she pulls away from him, too, as the year progresses. Now, just before Thanksgiving, Virginia's dad gets a strange phone call. Her perfect brother, Byron, was suspended from Columbia for allegedly date raping a girl.
Oh.
Which, yeah, kind of took a hard left turn there.
Oh, wow.
See that coming.
Yeah, so this throws Virginia into a spiral that causes her to ditch school and eventually sneak off to Washington to spend time with her best friend and their family, where she's able to finally come to terms with what happens, and she begins to really find out who she is and how she wants to live. Not every decision she makes pleases her parents, like having purple hair or the eyebrow ring that she gets, but Virginia sticks to her guns, and eventually they come around. Now, as I was reading this book, I was having a hard time figuring out why it got banned. It's way more tame than most of the stuff that you see on TV. But the superintendent at Carroll County, Maryland schools banned it because of the profane language and sexual content. It was also removed from school libraries in Colorado Springs. And Mackler was disappointed in this and said she was just trying to portray teenagers' experiences realistically. And I feel like if adults don't get that, then they should ban themselves. But I liked this book, and others agreed. It got several awards, including the Michael L. Prince Award and the ALA Best Book Award for Young Adults and the Pennsylvania School Libraries Association Young Adult Top 40 title. That was for Evil Robot. So, and this is, they got these awards because they like big butts and they cannot lie.
Very nice.
Let me before we continue. This is a different. Is this a different author than the Knocked Out by Nunga Nungas?
I am not familiar with that. I'm going to just give you a blank look.
I'm going to go ahead and say yes. I think maybe that person might be British because I think they use the word snog.
That would be Knocked Out by My Nunga Nungas by Louise Renison. Part of the Confessions of Georgia Nicholson series. This also happens to be another great segue.
All right. I guess it's my turn.
We kind of hate.
Rolling a tile tennis ball. All right. Feels both wrong and also so right to be celebrating banned books, especially as a yearly event. It feels wrong just because using the words banned and books in the same sentence makes it seem like I'm condoning the act of challenging and banning books, which I'm not. But thank goodness we as librarians, book lovers, and knowledge seekers spend this time every year to honor the great books in this world that, unfortunately, some crazy person or persons deemed unfit to read. Ugh. That being said, the book I choose to honor is In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. Most readers may be more familiar with Capote's fictional creations, such as the ever-famous and glamorous Holly Golightly from Breakfast at Tiffany's. Sadly, the characters in this tragic and suspenseful nonfiction tale aren't as bubbly and quirky as Miss Golightly. It's honestly just not that kind of story. The Clutter family of Holcomb, Kansas, were a well-known and wholesome type of family in a small, quiet community. Affluent in their own way and own community, they also lived in a trusting neighborhood where many families simply didn't lock their doors. The morning of November 15th, 1959, when all of their bodies were found, murdered in their own home, was a turning point for this small community and essentially an end of innocence in all of their minds. The investigation took some time before the murderers were found, but that's because of the perplexing circumstances. No one could understand why they were murdered in such a violent manner. Justice was eventually served, though, and the murderers were arrested and later executed. Based on the story, I suppose I can see why this material was at one point deemed unsuitable for high school required reading, but it wasn't for some time that a parent challenged the book for its sex, violence, and profanity when it was a required read for an advanced placement English class. The banning of the book took place in 1999, but the book was then reinstated in 2000 after protests. It's amazing it took 33 years, though, before the book was challenged or banned, considering how easily books are challenged these days. But it's a good thing, because after many years of working on it and even receiving assistance from friend and fellow author Harper Lee, the book is still considered to be the second best-selling true crime book in publishing history, just behind Helter Skelter, I think, is the first. I've been wanting to read this book for a while, not because of the story, but because of the writer and how the story was told. Capote and Harper interviewed several members of the community and individuals involved in the case, including the murderers. The only mistake in text that I learned about was the rehashment of Bobby Rupp's reaction to the news. Bobby Rupp was Nancy Clutter's boyfriend at the time of the murders and the last to see them alive. After he was told about the murders, Capote wrote that he, being Rupp, walked all the way down to the entrance of the Clutter property, just waiting to get a glimpse of the family. He naturally was a suspect to the murders, and many years later explained in a story that when Capote was in town interviewing for the book, he, being Rupp again, never really spoke to him at all, actually, so it's kind of interesting. It's a good story, but it sort of makes you wonder how much of it Capote kind of turned into a narrative as opposed to being factual. Not sure.
On that note, there is an article in an Esquire magazine I've read it called In Cold Fact that goes into that. Like somebody else read the book and he described something in the book and I forget, but it was logistically wrong. So that there's an Esquire story somewhere out there called In Cold Fact.
Yeah.
When the book came out.
That would be In Cold Fact by Philip K. Tompkins. Found in the June 1966 issue of Esquire magazine. You'll have to interlibrary loan that article, unless you can find it on the internet by nefarious means.
Some of the details in it that talks about what the Clutter family did beforehand really makes you wonder, like, how did you know that?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm curious. Mike?
Yeah, Crystal's Mystery Book Club, The Killer Thrillers, that's their book.
Ooh.
When this post, it'll be the following Thursday, the first Thursday in October.
okay.
So I may be reading that book soon.
Nice. It's good.
Yeah. I've heard good things. I've heard it's in cold good. That was bad even for me. since I only read books that are obviously for grown-ups, like Attack of the Fluffy Bunnies and King Baby by Kate Beaton, came out last week, gang.
Oh, it was a good.
It's amazing. It's the only picture book I've read where I was like, this is it. I want more.
The Princess. Their previous one was really good, too.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty good. Princess and the Pony.
Yeah, it's a farting pony.
Yeah, it's great. I'm sure it'll be banned because it's good. I'm back to plumbing the stuff I had to read school well yet again for Banned Books Week. Today I'm talking about The Last Waltz. Ha ha. Up on Cripple Creek, she sends me if I spring a leak. She mends me, I don't have to speak, but she defends me, a drunkard's dream if I ever did see one. I'm talking about Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury. Oh.
Long time listeners may recall.
Jeremy making fun of my weird verbal tics. Guy Montag is a fireman. In a future where he doesn't extinguish fires, he ignites them. All books are not only banned, they're to be immediately burned. Popular culture like television, radio, and Star Wars movies dominate everyone's existence. And books are seen as too elitist and pretentious. Montag is dedicated to his job until he meets people who risk their lives and or give them up for books, and he slowly, gradually, becomes aware of what books are and what they mean to people. He begins to save books from the flames and hoard them himself in his house. Eventually, his boss, Beatty, I don't know, his it looks like Beatty, so every time I, like, read it, I would picture, like, Warren Beatty. vivid imagination. Eventually, his boss, Beatty, catches on to him, and he orders him to burn down his own house. After watching everything he's loved go up in flames, Beatty tries to persuade Montag to join him in being an unthinking stooge of the state. For this, Montag turns the fire hose on him and burns him alive. In a scene in which 13-year-old Mike and 36-year-old Mike think it's super cool and do virtual high fives. Eventually, Montag goes to the wilderness and meets a group of hermits who have memorized books, in effect becoming living libraries of information, dedicating their lives to preserving knowledge for when people may need it again someday, which I thought was a really touching ending, you know, which
spoiler
is weird.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, you know, it's the end of the book, haha. Spoiler for you guys. Oh. Enjoy using that in your, you know, cite me in your future book reports. Exactly. Citing.
Well, Mike said.
Yeah. Some doofus on a podcast said.
It would say, according to longtime listeners.
Yeah. According to Napoleon the pig, because I didn't introduce myself at the end of beginning the podcast.
That's true.
I was probably the only one in my class who was really enthralled by this book, because even at the age of 13, I was a hardcore bibliophile and found a world where people were dedicated to So You Can Dance
and other terrible horrible children.
And I lived in Georgia. Man, nope. First verbal tics. Jeremy is still mad at the joke I made. You'll hear later in the podcast.
No, I'm not.
I found a terrible...
I was making fun of Georgia because I'm from Kentucky.
That's right. Enjoy your chicken and cornholing.
Wow.
It's not what you think, gang, because that's what I thought it was. No, apparently Kentucky would be something different. I found this horrifying future too horrible to contemplate. Interestingly enough, I found an article online recently, I think it was from Cracked or something, that said that Bradbury's intent for Fahrenheit 451 was not to rail against book censorship, but to decry the brain-numbing effects of television. I remember when I was reading the book, I agreed with the article because there's a passage where Montag is like profoundly disgusted that his wife really wants a fourth wall-sized television for their living room so she can be surrounded by her soap operas.
No.
And he just goes on, and it's just like, even as a 13-year-old, I was like, dude, like, she has a hobby and she enjoys it.
You know? Soap operas are stories,
jeez,
too.
Yeah. That's right. Jeez Louise. I would never decry soap operas unlike Star Wars movies.
Do you know where Ray Bradbury wrote Fahrenheit 451?
I do not.
In a library.
Really?
Yeah. They used to, where at the LA fitting. Library, he put coins, rented, and he wrote it in the public library.
Cool.
Yeah. Wow.
Huh. You're welcome, world.
Okay.
Now you know.
I'm going to talk about a movie that deals with censorship, and the movie is called Storm Center, written and directed by Daniel Tardush, and it stars Betty Davis, Brian Keith, and Kim Hunter. The plot is a small-town librarian is branded as a communist by local politicians because she refuses to withdraw a controversial book from the shelf of the library. The book is entitled The Communist Dream, and I saw this movie one day after school many years ago, long before I started to, before I decided to work in the library. It's one of the few movies in which a librarian is a hero. The movie was made in 1956 at the height of the Red Scare or the McCarthy Witch Hunt. When I look at this movie today, I wonder how this ever got made. In doing research, I found out while the movie was fictional, it was based on a librarian from Bartlesville, Oklahoma, Ruth W. Brown, who was a progressive librarian who fought for intellectual freedom and championed civil rights in her hometown. I'm quoting this from Wikipedia.
Robotic Snob Card.
Pardon me, would you have any gray poo?
Wikipedia cites its sources, and Bill could have easily referenced those if he chose to. In this case, the biographical details about Ruth Brown found in the Storm Center Wikipedia article are taken from the American Library Association's page about Storm Center and Miss Brown. If the article needed a citation, being in a library, Bill would be very well equipped to add one. As David Cronenberg once said about sex and violence, Wikipedia and libraries go together like bacon and eggs.
It's the only film screenwriter Daniel Tardish directed. He's best known for his script From Here to Eternity, based on James Jones's book. I feel that Storm Center is just as relevant now as it was back in the 1950s. So check out Storm Center. We have it in our collection. Jeremy.
In February of 2015, there was a 14-year-old student in the Rio Rancho public school system in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, which you can take, which you can reach by taking a left turn at Albuquerque.
Yes.
I mean, no.
I guess if you're going north on I-25, you would turn left. If you're going south, you turn right. So this kid checked out a copy of Gilbert Hernandez's Palomar, The Heartbreak Soup Stories. If you're not familiar with Hernandez, here's a very brief synopsis. Gilbert Hernandez and his brother Jaime, and sometimes their brother Mario, are the folks behind the long-running comic book series Love and Rockets, and they've received nearly every award the comics industry has to offer, and their work has been compared to writers like Gabriel Garcia Marquez. What their work is not is child pornography, which is what the mother of the Rio Rancho student called Palomar when she flipped through its pages and saw a naked little boy on one of them. You will have to contact Amanda in ILL to find out what's so offensive about this specific book, but we've got you covered for a bunch of Hernandez's other books. Julio's Day is the story of a man's life from his birth in 1900 to his death in 2000. It begins and ends in the exact same place. It's not a spoiler. It's about the day and the title is his life. So it sort of ends with like a black panel and then opens with like moving into like a boy, a baby's mouth, like screaming and crying. And then it ends with him as an old man and his mouth is open and he's dead. So it's really an uplifting book. That's a narrative device that I really like. And then along the way, we watch him grow and experience all the heartbreak and joy in life. And all that stuff that life has to offer. The book is really kind of has this sadness it's filled with kind of the sadness that is really devastating to read about, but also sort of life-affirming at the same time, if that makes any sense. Or maybe I'm just depressed. This is a trait that's shared by most of the Hernandez brothers' work that I've read. But what I've read is just a tiny fraction of what is out there. The first issue of Love and Rockets came out in 1981 when I was just a wee lad. And in 35 years, the brothers have created a vast world of interconnected stories, relationships, and characters, which can be a little daunting to dive into when you're used to superhero shenanigans like I am. But every time I've gone into their world, it's always very rewarding. And we have a lot of their stuff in the system, including works by Jaime and Gilbert. So what became of the Rio Rancho mom's claim that Hernandez's work was child pornography? The book was defended by the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, who, along with the Kids' Right to Read Project, argued that one parent's voice should not be the sole arbiter of what is or isn't on a library's shelves. The Rio Rancho school system initially did not follow their own policies and then just deleted the book from the library entirely. But after there was a public outcry from groups like the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, there was a committee that was formed. They reviewed the book and they voted 5-3 to retain it. Now, later on, through a Freedom of Information Act thing, the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund uncovered emails between the school's principal and vice principal in which they were saying they hoped that the superintendent would overturn this decision. So the lesson is enemies of freedom do not give up, which is why its defenders must also do that too as well.
I would just like to clarify that you would ask me about this book because I might get the book borrowed through interlibrary loan, not because I have experience with child pornography.
Whoa! Yes.
Just a clarification. Definitely. So we're all on the same. Yes.
It's an important clarification.
I'm sorry. That's true. That was not me making a bad joke, and I apologize if that came out that way.
But I'm just clarifying.
I was not making. I was just saying you got to get the book. So
yes,
you can read
I'm happy to try to borrow the book for you.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Jeremy.
What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well, maybe the library has it. Maybe the library doesn't. But either way, it's tickling our fancy.
Bill?
I was just talking to me.
Yeah, I was just doing a Kim Gordon impression.
Are you talking to me?
You must be talking to me. Oh, hey.
Of course. Do you realize that this year is the 40th year anniversary of that 1970s classic Taxi Driver? And on October 16th and 19th, 2016, they will be showing Taxi Driver as a special event at the Opry Mills Theater.
De Niro. In Bang the Drum Slowly, the critics called him a brilliant new talent. After Mean Streets, they said he was a genius. For his performance in The Godfather Part II, they gave him the Academy Award.
One minute. Just get me out of here, all right?
Now, Robert De Niro creates a terrifying portrait of life on the edge of madness.
Tabby, just forget about this. It's nothing.
Taxi Driver, a film by Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, people do anything in front of a taxi driver. I mean anything. Yeah. People too cheap to rent a hotel room.
Oh, driver, hurry up, will you?
People want to embarrass you. It's like you're not even there. It's like, you know, like a taxi driver doesn't even exist.
This city here is like an open sewer, you know? It's full of filth and scum.
I think I know what you mean, Travis. But it's not going to be easy.
Them guys get to be a Secret Service man.
What?
I was just curious because I thought maybe I'd make a good one.
Hey, what kind of guns do you guys carry?
38s, 45s, 357 Magnums, something bigger maybe.
Hi, I'd like to volunteer.
Why?
Why? Because I think that you are the most beautiful woman I've ever seen.
The taxi driver is looking for a target. Thanks. Getting ready, getting organized, preparing himself for the only moment in his life that will ever mean anything.
How much for everything?
$350 for the Magnum, $250 for the 38, $1.25 for the 25, $150 for the 38.
That taxi driver's been staring at us.
You talking to me? You talking to me?
I don't know who's weirder, you or me.
Talking to me? Well, who the hell else are you talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here.
I don't believe I've ever met anyone quite like you.
Oh, yeah?
You will never see a more chilling performance than this. Robert De Niro in Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver.
And there is going to have a special conversation that was recorded at the Tribeca Film Festival with Robert De Niro, Jodie Foster, and Martin Scorsese, the director of the film. Hope to see you there, because that's where I'll be. That's what's tickling my fancy. Mike?
Yeah, watch out for the Martin Scorsese cameo. that he's one of the passengers.
Yep.
Hmm. Yeah, I think his wife's having an affair or something.
Right.
Yeah.
And then he replaced another actor who was supposed to do that.
Yeah. Was it his mom? Because his mom always does cameos.
No, it was his mom having it.
Did she call in or something? I heard, yeah.
No, it's this guy from the Ace Trucking Company. I can't remember his name, but it was he's been in other, he's in Mean Streets too.
Yeah.
Mike fell asleep during that part.
Yeah, Mean Streets, a cure for insomnia. So today, I'm actually going to recommend something that Bill recommended a long time ago. Whoa. Long time listeners may remember, or as Jeremy likes to say, no one remembers. I looked at the calendar for next week, or this week, and guess what Saturday is? October 1st. Shocktober 1st! So, I thought I would recommend a little book I read last year called Blackwater, The Complete Caskey Family Saga by Michael McDowell, which Bill recommended once.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's the complete Blackwater series from the 80s. A series about a flood in Perdido, Alabama, that washes up a woman named Eleanor, who meddles in the town's affairs. Ooh, and marries into the big rich family there, and she's also a fish person who sometimes disembowels people.
What?
And it's one of those, like, sometimes it'll be like 200 pages of turgid family drama, and then suddenly she tears a dude's head off. It's like, whoa, okay, this is pretty cool. Tell me more. It was weird because it's like over 1,000 pages or something like that. Like, jeez. I read it on the Kindle because you had to get it through Kindle Gang. We don't have it. But, the whole time I was like getting near the end, and I'm like, no, don't end on me. This is so great. Oh, tell me more. Oh, fish people. really good. If you don't mind, again, it gets very soap opery about, like, the family politics of this town, and stuff. But if you stick with it, it'll get its hooks in you. Disastrous evil hooks. And, Michael McDowell also wrote the script for, like, Beetlejuice, a classic for me and not for anybody else in this podcast. But we do have a book of his called The Elementals, which I may check out later during Shocktube.
How many bowls of Frankenberry have you had yet already? Because it's around, right?
I think it's out already.
I haven't seen it, but I haven't been looking for it.
I've heard twitterings in the wild that in some places Frankenberry has returned.
Has
returned from his limbo,
his
yearly hibernation. So soon, Tony the Tiger will be bummed, and I will get my annual call from Kellogg's going like, Mike, are you okay?
Halloween Oreos are out already.
You really eat Frosted Flakes all the time? Is that for real?
That's true. Yes.
Okay. I mean, that's not
daily thing.
That's not a diss.
Pretty much.
That's fine.
Sometimes, it's like, well, I guess I'll try something else. And then my tongue is like, slaps me in the face. What's wrong with you?
That is good.
This is inferior cereal. Why do you make me weep? And on that salivary note, what do you got?
Just a quick note on the Blackwater fun trivia. I might have said this before, but it influenced Stephen King to write the Green Mile series.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Full of fun facts.
That's where he got the idea from.
Well, that's cool.
I also now have that song, the Oh Blackwater, keep on moving, Mississippi, won't you keep on shining on me.
That's a much better reference than the evil mercenary group that plagued the Middle East for a while, which is what I was thinking of Blackwater.
Private security firm, won't you keep killing civilians?
It's not quite as dark.
On that incendiary note, what do you have, Sarah?
Yeah, on that note. it's been a while since I've discussed music, so I thought I'd throw some new stuff at our lovely listeners. While this album is new, this band is not, and you will most likely have heard of them before. Coincidentally, also essential parts of our anatomy, if you're a science lover, the band, the head, and the heart.
Oh,
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
I was like, what band are you listening to? Oh, my.
Oh, yes, very tasty. The head and the heart recently released their third LP called Signs of Light, and it radiates a healthy diversity of sound. Aha. From the catchy hit track All We Ever Knew, that's been playing up the radio waves for a few weeks now and provides the listener with an assurance that, yes, you will be hearing a little of our classic sound, to a healthy mix of rock and pop with rhythm and blues or I Don't Mind. They even have a song called Library Magic that's reminiscent of what a library should sound like. Peaceful, and in my opinion, with a little folk. Just a little bit. And the chorus line, there will always be better days, is a fact. That is very true for a library.
I'll tell myself that at night.
Yeah, into my tear-stained pillow.
Drawn to that sort of library magic, whispering through the dusty aisles, watching all the thinkers read, trying to keep a grown man quiet. It's like pulling teeth on a winter's eve, cracks and poles in unfamiliar roads. I'm on this one to find out.
In comparison to previous albums, I suppose you can see that they're exploring their sound a little more instead of simply putting out more of their traditional Indian folk sounds, but playing the Mumford card a bit and putting out more variety. I can dig that. A band that can play many different sounds but sound equally amazing each time is impressive. Besides, this band still stands today as my favorite Live on the Green performance from when they came in 2014, so I'm happy to hear anything they put out. Yes, Hoopla has this album. If you're able to access it on Hoopla and can play it, check it out. Amanda?
Okay, so my Tickle Fancy today features a book that somehow randomly made its way across my desk. And I also chose to read it due to the title, so apparently today is title day. How to Make White People Laugh by Najin Farsad caught my attention because, hey, you know, I'm white. I like to laugh. I'm easy. Didn't need to go very deep on that.
That's pretty simple.
Plus, I was intrigued to find out that Farsad is an Iranian-American Muslim female comedian slash filmmaker slash honey mustard enthusiast.
Mm. Whoa.
Those are her words, not mine. So, you know, now I've read a few books here and there about Iran, and when I think of that country, the first thing that, you know, pops into my head is female comedians. So I was like, I'm checking this one out. So it, you know, before we go farther, I have to say that Farsad was actually born in Connecticut. Her parents immigrated from Iran with her older brother before she was born. So that made me a little less nervous for her. I don't feel like they're going to, like, she's American, so they can't really come get her.
That's a good point.
She performs what she has deemed social justice comedy. So she and a few fellow Muslim comedians have traveled across the country with a free comedy show. They didn't charge for tickets, that's free, called Here Come the Muslims. And they would also do things like set up ask a Muslim question booths around the town they visited. So if you walked by and had a question about Muslims, you could ask them.
Like, a documentary called something.
It may be. I think she had she's done a...
Future correction. Yeah, there's a documentary about a bunch of Muslim comedians who travel the country.
Yeah,
is it called Here Come the Muslims?
It's some joke about, like, you know... Muslims and...
That would be... Muslims are coming! We have it on Hoopla.
So anyway, Farsad tells the story of how she worked with and then had to sue the MTA in New York City on a poster campaign designed to both promote Muslims and their movies. I guess there was, like, this big smear campaign that somebody paid actual money for, posters that were like, Muslims are bad and we should kill them all.
Yeah.
And so then they kind of went back behind and said, no, Muslims are cool, come watch our movie. But then they decided it was too political. So anyway, she goes into all of that. She also explains why she went to Columbia University as an African-American studies major, you know, even though, as she is, as I've already mentioned, an Iranian-American Muslim female comedian and honey mustard enthusiast. So if this intrigues you, there's a TED Talk that she gives that is kind of a short version. And this is kind of where the book came from. It's about 8 minutes long. And I'll try to send Evil Robot the link so that we can link to that for you. This will give you kind of an idea of what Farsad is about. Now, I don't think she's going to knock Tina Fey from her perch atop my favorite female comedian post anytime soon. But I did laugh out loud at her book, and I am white. So thank you.
I've really come around on mustard myself.
Honey mustard is hard good. To beat.
I think mustard's okay.
I think I like spicy mustard better, but I get the...
But sometimes you don't want spicy.
So well, sometimes, it can overpower the recipe.
The sweet and sour. Yeah.
I like I get this Engelhofer. It's got, like, the seeds in it.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, so you get the initial vinegary burst, and then, like, and you get the seeds, and it's, like, a little more mustardy, but a little, just a hint of... Spice is pretty good. It's pretty good. I do like sweets, though.
I find mustard a gas.
Feature show. Topic.
Wow.
Mustard.
Wow.
A little butt bitey.
Yeah.
I find mustard a gas. I mean, that's really good. Is the thing. I'm not.
Okay.
No.
That was a disparaging.
No, that's excellent. Okay. That's. I think I'm getting a brain turmeric from that. Yeah,
ooh,
see?
Yeah.
And, I don't know. That's another. That's kind of, what's tickling my fancy? I read this book. So Evil Robot did a display of, like, hey, did you like Stranger Things? Read these books. And I checked out a couple of those books. So he would have to put some more books on the display. But I was also looking at a
nice.
I was also looking at a list. I was also looking at a list online because, you know, it was like, hey, if you like this, read this. And it mentioned this book, Paper Girls by Brian K. Vaughan and Cliff Chang.
Is this comic book writer Brian K. Vaughan?
It is. I have not gotten into really any of his work before. People love that Saga book. I know Mike likes Saga. I've tried to read it and I can't get into it.
Oh.
He does a thing that I don't like that people do where, like, it's just quips all the time. Everything's quips and, like, dialogue is all quips and it bothers the hell out of me. I don't mind it in real life. But
I was
going
to say, Evan, seriously.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Are we friends?
Yeah. I don't mind it in real life, but there's just something about it on the page where it's like, it takes me out of it because it's like, if that's your personality, that's fine. But like that, every character should not have that personality, and not everybody is good at bantering, which sometimes I'm really bad at it, despite really liking it. And so as a writerly tick, it bothers me, and I think he's guilty of that sometimes too. But this book didn't really have that, and I like that a lot. And it was recommended. Because if you like Stranger Things, and there's a scene, so it's about these girls who are paper girls, and they uncover a dark secret in their small town.
I question, do you mean like paper boy, like
yeah,
throwing to, okay,
yeah, they're girls.
I know. I was initially like, are they made of paper?
Yeah.
Like, do they have paper manipulation powers, like in Chinese mythology?
Yes, but cool. they're all origami
see,
people.
Read or die, gang. Yeah. Eat manga. It's great.
But they're in a small town, they're paper girls, they're delivering papers, and they uncover secrets in their town and open this larger world. And in one of the scenes in the background, a girl sitting in her room, and there's a Monster Squad poster on the wall, which is sort of also Stranger Things kind of thing. And it's, all female leads, but done by male creators. So at least there's some representation going on. And it was a quick, fun read. So check that out, Paper Girls. Corrections. Does anyone have corrections? Nope. No one.
Nope.
For more information, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org. Wait for it.
.org. Yeah, and our theme music is by
Adam Dane.
Also,
the show was edited by an evil robot.
You can subscribe to the Pop Mega Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Please do it. Please.
It's fun. I did it this morning.
It'll make your week. 7 days without the Pop Mega Podcast makes 1 week. Talk about the song Sweet Sunshine, which is the closing track on Experimental Jet Set Trash and No Star. It's a something of a ballad about Kim Gordon growing up in Los Angeles.
Oh, boy. Tell Mike who she went to high school with.
She went to high school with and dated Oingo Boingo frontman and film composer.
Composer?
Danny Elfman.
Danny Elfman. That's cool.
You can find that out in her book, Girl in a Band.
When's it coming out?
I've never heard of this book.
Yeah, you know, she should write a book. I'm sure she's got a lot of good stories.
But maybe. I bet Jeremy would like it.
Yeah. I heard she dated Danny Elfman.
Long-time listeners may recall that everybody hates me. Guess I'll go eat worms. Elvis Costello.